This is part five of a five-part series in which I've tried to summarize my recently published Sefer, trying to look for religious, theological, moral, and cultural responses to October 7th. It is a Sefer I wrote looking for meaning, looking for faith, looking back to, of course, our Chazal and our Masara, my Rebbeim, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha, Rav Amital, Zichrono Livracha, looking for guidance. In the first four sections of this five-part series, I tried to deconstruct the war into four different tiers, four different layers, and I address each of them in different sections. The obvious part of the war, which I didn't address, is the military encounter, the political struggle, the geopolitical struggle. That's not my primary issue. In the first section, I talked about the hijacking of Hashem's presence in this world and the Chilul Hashem of October 7th, which happened on Shabbos, attacking our people on their land, speaking of a God who's angry. In the second section, I spoke about some of the religious differences between Islamic fundamentalism and Judaism that have been surfacing during this struggle. Tzelem Elokim, do you honor and revere mankind or man as a unique and distinctive creature of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, apart from nature, just like Hashem's apart from nature? Do we have a death wish or do we celebrate life? In the third section, I spoke about the rise and the awakening of this monster called anti-Semitism, and the modern incarnations of traditional forms of anti-Semitism. Everything in history is cyclical. It all cycles upon itself. You just have to learn to detect and see through the modern shell. In the fourth section, I spoke about all these broken cultural narratives that have been weaponized against our people. Postmodernism, wokeism, intersectionality, virtue signaling, the lack of any truth. And we talked about how our job in this, or our function, our task in this world, is to bring Hashem's presence in this world and to create a culture that's healthy, that surrounds healthy moral values, and some of them have eroded over the past four decades, and how it's not surprising to me that this battle doesn't just include a military component, doesn't just include a religious component, isn't just channeling or fomenting anti-Semites, but it has been pivoted on this whole cultural struggle. In this section, I'd like to talk about not another tier of this war. This isn't a war, Chas v'Shalom, but a project of this war. The project is obviously the unity of our people. The unity of our people, which unfortunately was so terribly, terribly torn and fractured in the months and year leading up to October 7th. And how has the war reshaped unity, communal identity, international Jewish identity? So the word we've all used is unity, but I think it's important to be more specific about what unity we have been privileged with, how we have achieved it, because by defining it rather than just sloganizing it, we may be able to hold on to it. So I think that we've achieved unity on three different fronts. The obvious is we faced a common threat. Chazal tell us, Gedola hasaras hatabas mimemches nevi'im. Hashem sent Navi after Navi, prophet after prophet, to chastise, to rebuke, to call Am Yisrael to Tshuva. We were hard-headed, wooden-headed. We didn't listen. We were obstinate. The second that Haman received the signet of Ahasuerus that empowered him to issue a genocidal decree and threaten our lives, all of a sudden, Lech Kenosis Kol HaYehudim V'Tzimuel, everyone gathers together. It's to face a common enemy. There's no way, no better way to unite people than put them into the same foxhole, or in the modern incarnation, put them into the same bomb shelter. And that's a literal, but also a figurative statement. So we all faced a common threat. It was existential. We faced death. We faced death together. We stood together at funerals. We stood together in hospitals. We stood together in bomb shelters. And we were able to achieve a unity that had eluded us beforehand. And probably the most significant symbol or icon was Achim LeNeshek, was a organization that was very vocal in opposing the government in the months leading up, very vocal, very aggressive, and they were opposing the judicial reform that the government was sponsoring. And within hours or minutes of October 7th, they pivoted and they became a major, major organization helping families of hostages locate their loved ones and many other important national tasks. The second way that we have faced unity is just the war effort, not the threat, but the war effort. I like to talk about the difference between unity of speech and unity of ideas and unity of action. We could speak about unity and talk about our unity, or we could actually work shoulder to shoulder, side by side. And just the war effort, especially those who obviously served at the front. In the army, there are no titles. You're not rabbi, you're not doctor, you're not professor, you're not esquire. You perform the same tasks, you drive in the same tanks, you battle the same barbaric subhuman terrorists. Unfortunately, you're thrown into the line of fire jointly. And it's not just the army, but it's in every sector that has been necessary to support this war, whether it's visiting people, visiting army bases, bringing food, traveling, bringing people to army, whatever it has been. Those are titleless activities, and those are activities we perform jointly. So unity is not just facing a threat and feeling more connected. Unity is also shouldering the burden side by side. Shoulders don't have titles. People's heads have titles. That's why they swell. Shoulders, you just carry weight and you perform tasks. And that's what's been so leveling about the war. And when you level off title, you create greater equality. The third aspect that has led to this unity is, in order for people to be unified, they have to have a common story. What is our story? Stories unify people. We're serving the same larger narrative. I think from my perspective, the United States has lost its story. Its story used to be democracy, about building a city on the hill, an experiment in democracy. What happens when that succeeds after World War II? What's your story? Your story can't be the next iPhone. Your story can't be the next Oscar Awards. It has to be some larger story that unites people. Those are self-serving experiences to get the next iPhone, to win the next award. What's the common story? In Israel, we had a common story. We were a people that were condemned to wander this earth for 2,000 years. Whether you brought a religious overlay to that because Hashem had condemned us as a punishment for our failures, or whether you weren't religious, it was just historical fact, and now we reconvened in our ancient homeland to build a state that would protect our people and that would reclaim our ancient heritage at whatever level you felt that heritage had to be reclaimed. You know what? I think we lost that story. We shifted from that story to a different story. The startup nation, the entrepreneurial nation, technology, cyberspace, nitafim, cherry tomatoes. They're all important, obviously. But when it becomes your story, that's not a story that unites people. That's a story of profit. That's a story of reference. It's not a story. You can't be united as a startup nation. You can feel pride. And I think that this war has shaved off some of those layers of stories and allowed us to return to that core story, because it's so existentialist. Why are we in this country? Why won't they let us live in this country? Why are we facing such anti-Semitism? So I think at a deeper level, we've re-achieved unity, not only because we faced a common threat, and not only because we walked and marched and worked shoulder to shoulder in experiences which level off differences, but because, I hope, we've recovered a story. And to the degree that we can preserve that common story, we can preserve our unity. Now, I think this is also, this war has also unified Jews across the world and changed their opinion about Israel. I think that Jews across the world started to take Israel for granted. You just fly in for Yom Tov, fly in to attend a tekes, fly in for a day. There's plenty of hotels in Tel Aviv. And I think October 7th, reminded everyone not to take this country for granted, certainly in this country, but I think that a deep impact upon Jews outside of this country. And there's more of proprietary ownership and shareholder. People feel like we are part of Israel. And even though we may not live in Israel, we have to, in some cases, make personal sacrifices for Israel. When you make a personal sacrifice, you're much more invested. And I think in particular, it has awakened Jewish identity within people whose Jewish identity was either frayed, absent, silent, or defined in ways which didn't center Israel. Now, why this happened? I think in some cases because they saw the threat of anti-Semitism that shook their narrative and that shattered their conception about how Western society had accepted Jews as equal members. But I think it's more than that. I think that Rav Amital would always tell us that as much as they suffered in the Holocaust, they would never, never trade places with their Nazi oppressors if they had the choice. Because the ugliness of a genocidal regime was just so abhorrent that they'd rather be the victims than be the murderers and the butcherers. And I think we've seen such ugliness. We've seen the seamy side of modern society. We thought society was enlightened. We thought society was elegant. We thought society was educated. We thought, and just the academic rod in some of the Ivy League colleges, which have served as cesspools for anti-Semitic hatred. I think people have seen evil. And when you see evil, you revert back to a culture which you may have taken for granted, you may have neglected, but which you sense inherently to be a culture of virtue and a culture of dignity and a culture of nobility. I think this is, of course, Hashem's echo that he placed within Jewish heart, that even though Jewish hearts may wander far from Har Sinai, may wander far from Torah Mitzvot, and may wander far from ritual, those hearts still respond to nation and people and land. And I see we're seeing the emergence of identity. Identity not based on religion. I think that as someone that supports secular Zionism, I don't aspire to be a secular Zionist, but I ratify it. I think we're seeing the value of secular Zionism to maintain commitment and partnership with Jewish destiny, even for those who no longer wear tefillin every day or keep Shabbos in the classic sense. So I think that's the second project. The first project is to create unity within our nation. The second project is to create unity amongst the international community of the Jewish people. I think that we have struggles that lie ahead of us. I think that those who showed up at secular Israeli funerals of soldiers who died in battle and then call them kedoshim, or even if they didn't show up, well, how will that play after the war? Will you still be able to look at a secular Israeli and call them kadosh? I believe that there's a kedusha to every Jew. I believe that in secular Zionism, there are values that I see as stemming from a world of Kedusha. They may not express themselves in Kedusha. They may not clothe themselves in Kedusha. But I believe there's an inherent Kedusha to every Jew. And when Jews express their own culture and their own desire and yearning, it has a holiness to it. I wonder about people who were not able to identify secular Israeli Jews and ratify them. Will they be able to after using the term Kedoshim to describe those who died al Kiddush Hashem? Are they just kedoshim because they died al Kiddush Hashem, or to the degree that their willingness to die al Kiddush Hashem to protect our people and our homeland is reflective of a value system that has kedusha in life? And of course, it intrigues me to see what will happen in the Haredi world. I don't say this from a political position. I'm just right now discussing yes draft or no draft, but I think there is a coming together, and I think that there are certain values that are far more palatable and far more attractive to people in that world. There may be words and slogans that are still alien and foreign to that world, such as Reshit Tzvichas Gulaseinu, such as seeing redemptive or messianic value in Jewish sovereignty. But again, when you peel it down to the core, peoplehood, land, unity, partnership, all for one, one for all, anti-Semitic hatred, I think those values, which were less palatable to that community in the past because they came robed or cloaked in these larger ideologies that they are not comfortable with, I think those ideologies have been removed, and some of those core values are very, very resonant within that community. So I call this the project of October 7th, the project to identify how we've achieved unity, to try to preserve it, the project of what has happened to the international community of Jews and how to perpetuate it. And of course, how will secular Jews in Israel be viewed by their religious counterparts in the wake of October 7th? And will a Haredi world that isn't on board with some of the, I don't want to say platitudes, but some of the larger ideas of redemption and messianism, will they be able to retain the resonance that some of the more low-scale substantive ideas have had? Will that continue to resonate within that community? It's a project, and with Hashem's help, will be successful. Okay? Shkoyach.